Hello and welcome to a special edition of History Hack called History Matters, in which a group of historians will tell you why it's stupid to go around pulling down every statue in the country and judging everybody in the past on our own present set of morals. What I really like about this is that this is not a group of fusty old right-wing historians or a load of yobbos. This is a group of intelligent young historians from a wealth of different backgrounds that study a wealth of different subjects and are more than one ethnicity, having an intelligent conversation about this and just bringing it to you with a bit more nuance than can be achieved on Twitter, the cesspool that it is, and Facebook and things like that when you're limited to 240 characters. So Zach White is with us, our Napoleonic historian. He's always with us. We love him. So Zach's a PhD candidate in Napoleonic history. We have Owen Rees with us. Hi, Owen, who's a ancient historian and author. We thought it would be good to have the ancient point of view on this. We have Marcus Cribb, who's a manager at Apsley House, and within his remit falls looking after several statues. Hey, Marcus.
Hi there. It certainly does, yes. Hello.
And we have James Smith with us as well, who is a naval historian attached to King's and was the guy behind the very snippy set of graphics that I was putting out last week about Nelson and his column. Hey, James.
Hello there.
Coulson, let's just stick a pin in that. I don't think anyone's got a problem with that one coming down. That had been a bone of contention for a long, long time. And I don't think anyone's sorry to see the back of it. I'm not, providing, as I think it's supposed to, it's going to go into a museum, isn't it? So we can educate people about why this once revered man it's not appropriate to have his statue on display in the public domain anymore. Is that right?
Well, I think you've hit on a really important bit at the beginning, which is education.
Yeah.
More than anything else, education and a chance for open debate. It is an open, intelligent debate, but education primarily on all sides, really, really important.
I think we all have huge issue, don't we, with these lists of statues that suddenly started being created, where someone obviously got onto Google and decided that they were going to purge or encourage people to purge the country of these statues. Let's go to Zach first and let Zach make his points, and then we can all come in and discuss them, because I know he's prepared some things he wants to say.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, I mean, where do we honestly begin? It's been really interesting to try and get involved in this debate on social media, because like you say, Twitter is really probably not the place to have this recent conversation. And people have come back and some people have gone, oh, that's a woke perspective. And others have said, oh, you're being insidious. Neither of which kind of really helps to move things forwards. And the issue I have, for those who turn around and say, oh, well, my perspective is woke, and I'll explain what my thinking on this is, and perhaps you folks disagree. Well, that's the whole point of having this chat. Mm. People turn around and say, well, we have to judge people by the standards of the time. Well, I'm not being funny, but we've never actually done that, because it's always been about our perception of those individuals, and that's influenced by our perspective on the present. So, for example, nobody realistically is going to turn around and say, we need to put up more statues to Hitler. If you're trying to put up a statue to Stalin, depending on what country you live in, you're going to have quite a hard time trying to make that happen. And historians have been having a debate since the year dot about the issues of conscious bias, deliberately trying to force your own agenda on something, but also of unconscious bias, that sense of whether or not you can properly divorce yourself from your own personal perceptions and whether or not that influences how you write your history. And people often say that you actually can't divorce yourself from your unconscious bias. I'm not convinced that it's impossible. I think it's difficult, but I think there are ways that you can kind of help, at least, to try and reduce the impact of that unconscious bias. And there's no doubt in my mind that, as you've just said, some of these people need to come down. Coulson, prime example. The landscape should reflect 21st century society rather than just 19th century principles. But when it comes to my kind of insidiousness, I don't think, and call this a radical perspective if you like, but I don't think tearing down and burning is the solution on many levels. For one thing, if you're going to look at anybody pre-1950, arguably even later than that, you've got to recognise that society was racist and misogynistic and homophobic and elitist and had many other flaws. It was an age of empire and of limited suffrage. of separate spheres for men and women, when women were meant to sort of stay at home and look after the kids and cook dinner whilst men went out and earned a wage and did the proper stuff of politics and running the country, inverted commas. People were a product of their time. And so we shouldn't be surprised that some of these key figures had racist, homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic views. That doesn't change the fact that in many cases, they also, and this is crucial, made hugely significant contributions to our national history. And as a society, we've got to confront that dichotomy. We have to talk about how we feel about that. We need to have that conversation about the fact that our key historical figures held views that nowadays disgust us. And this comes to the nub of my argument. If you pull down all of these statues and monuments, that can actually be unhelpful. And those aren't my words. Those are the words of Afua Hirsch, who first advocated reappraising our monuments in that Guardian article. She mentioned it a number of times in podcasts that she did in the time. I think the article came out in 2017. And also those of Professor Sir Jeff Palmer, who's the human rights activist and life sciences expert. He'd said that in a recent interview for Channel 4 News. So for me, and this is just my perspective, if you take them down, what you actually do is hide a really uncomfortable truth. If you took them out of sight, it is so much easier to just ignore it. And again, this is just my opinion. I feel we need to confront this, not just kind of sweep it away, in order to emphatically tackle subliminal racist attitudes that continue to persist as a result of society in previous generations. So I'm not saying do nothing. As we've said already, Colson needs to come down. No debates about that. I've been reading up on Rhodes. I mean, it's difficult without a library of proper history books because you can't trust what you read on the internet. Mm. And personally, I struggle to see what was great about the book. But the point is, I'm not best placed to judge that. I'm not an expert on empire. And so if I, as a historian who sort of understands that some of the nuances on empire, thinks, actually, you know what? Just walking straight up to the Rhodes' statue and sticking a chain around it and attaching it to a car isn't the best way. Then this kind of mob rule attitude of, hey, let's tear it down after reading a Wikipedia page, really isn't the way to go.
Yeah.
I was just thinking what you were saying earlier about judging by standards in the past, you know, we should judge them by standards in the past, their own standards, things like that. People always ignore that there was dissent. So, you know, when we talk about, they were racist, they agreed with slavery. Not everyone did. Mm. You know, there has always been debate on these figures. Notably, you know, if you're ever looking for dissent on most things we consider moral or immoral, you'll probably find a Quaker involved.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like these time periods live in a moral vacuum that only exists there and then, and everyone somehow enjoys this homogenous viewpoint. There is such a complexity here, and I think it's interesting Zach's point on that complexity exists both in the past and in the present debate as well. I mean, you mentioned about Stalin statues, and obviously in nations like the Ukraine where they've gone through this process of decommunization and things like that. You're absolutely right. I suppose what's interesting here, and I know we'll get onto it later, is figures like Nelson, Wellington, and the like in our history, where we have lots of statues of them. And you wonder, is it appropriate to remove one from maybe one context, but not another? Do you think that dichotomy can exist? I'd aim that at you, Zach, because it's your...
I think the context is definitely key. But there is an issue of escalation from that. And we need to be very clear about the context within which a statue exists in the first place. For me, the nuance is absolutely vital in all of this, because we need to decide which ones come down, but then crucially, the ones that remain, they can't just be left necessarily as they are. And we need to think about how we change the ones that remain to accurately reflect that these people weren't perfect and that they held views that do nowadays disgust us.
I think this is a really good point to bring James in, because obviously James was doing the stuff about Nelson's column that we were putting out last week. And this is something whereby the context of that column, James, is not just about Nelson, is it? It's about the whole square, and it's not necessarily about one man. And the context in which that column was being judged was all wrong and ill-educated.
Yeah, and I think this kind of exposes the real heart question here, which is statues are tricky in every country. They sort of tell you things about your past, good and bad. I found that quite often people have issues with their own history rather than actually history itself, but they sort of take that on history itself. And I think the other matter is that many of these statues, of course, are of people who are products of the times, and they might have had some attitudes which are untenable today. The difference is, of course, that we ultimately do stand on the shoulders of this history. We have developed our policies and our attitudes from that. And I always see history as kind of a repository of wisdom. And this is the issue when it comes down to Trafalgar Square and Nelson's column. And many forget that it's not Lord Nelson's column per se. Nelson's column and Trafalgar Square are there for really two issues. One is actually talking about what Professor Andrew Lambert calls the sea power state. It's talking about the maritime and naval history of Britain, which when you look at it, it's to do with we as human beings are land-dwelling creatures, and we don't really understand the sea. It's a place we work on. So Trafalgar Square was actually put there also to be a place near decision makers and for the nation understand what was going on, and primarily that how the Royal Navy had been being invaded in 1805, and that Lord Nelson's column was there to celebrate the entire campaign to stop invasion. So it's kind of when they were saying, well, this is a memorial to slavery, actually that's not correct. People seem to be quite misguided, that many of these statues are emulating or celebrating or worshipping specifically slavery. And if you look at Nelson's column, the plaques on them are all, or basically the entire campaign, the Royal Navy's campaign, to defeat Napoleon, stop the country being invaded in 1805. And that's a place that the nation would be able to come together. And I sort of know, actually, if you think about Trafalgar Square today, how many key sort of movements and times in British history has Trafalgar Square been in the background? You think of anything from, I don't know, women's rights, LGBT rights, anti-war protests. Yeah, they generally sort of start at Trafalgar Square. But this sort of worshipping or idea that all of these statues reflect specifically or emulate something as simple as slavery, I think is a bit wrong. And the scenes themselves that we saw some of these statues being attacked, not just in Britain, were reminiscent of sort of the Middle East or somewhere after a revolution where people's passions have gone wild. And it's sometimes hiding that people who want to push through a political agenda, and that if you do not support tearing down statues, that you are somehow racist. And this is kind of simplistic in myopic view. And some are rightfully worried, as we know from history, one of the most important things from studying history is what happens when you have mobs going around like this attacking national culture. And that people become more emboldened about what they can do in society by testing the limits of violence and what the rest of society will tolerate. Now, they're important conversations to be had about the past, but the worst way you can do it is by going around being thugs and doing violence.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like, just look at the scenes this weekend where, I mean, the media would have you believe that everyone went down there was a football supporting Lagerlout right wing nut job doing their Nazi salutes. It wasn't the case. I'd seen some former paras down there just calmly sitting in front of Nelson's column and just saying, I just will not tolerate anyone trying to force their way past me, but I'm not here to fight anybody. But I'm going to make my point, which is essentially what we were joking about doing, isn't it, James? Was saying that if historians have to form a ring around it and educate people, there is a way to achieve this. And putting a list online to go and vandalise and I mean, that idiot that worked for, I presume she doesn't no longer works for that Hertfordshire Museum. I think it was Hertfordshire, because she's going online telling people how to melt bronze or whatever it was she was doing. Marcus, what do you make of this? Because your remit as one of the managers at Apsley House is to, well, safeguard or look after statues of Wellington, isn't it?
It It is to protect and also highlight their importance. By effectively, they are there to represent the past. There's a cross section. The Nelson's column in Trafalgar Square is almost an odd one out, but it actually depicts the crew of, I believe, Just Victory. Owen and James will be able to tell me otherwise, but I believe, you know, at least the sailors at Trafalgar. And most of the other statues we have, Picton was one that was picked up very recently in the news. We don't often commemorate the normal soldier of the era, or at least the working men and women from various backgrounds. And so we do that through highlighting individuals. And so you've got to almost think that they are the top of an iceberg that is being supported by a myriad of society and all sorts of backgrounds underneath them, supporting whatever their efforts. The other one is on damage. What they don't see is the expertise that goes into the cleaning and maintenance, which can be really costly. And it's either done through charities like English Heritage or through council and government grants. And basically, the funds are there being taken out of something else because they're reactive planning. You're not hoping to have to put money towards cleaning vandalism. So by vandalising statues wherever they are in the world, you are taking the money out of charities that would be hoping to spend it more productively, or out of the government. So you believe that your cause is more important than some of our national funds, which ought to might include, you know, relief for worthy causes, or health services and mental health services and such like. So there is an element there that you believe that your cause is more important. So you must remember what's behind the statue maintenance is very cost-worthy to other people.
It just, in a way, that epitomises the point that I was trying to make on Twitter last week in amongst the shitstorm, that you're not going to make the future a better place by attacking the past. Your focus and your energy should be spent on the here and now, not on going around spray painting statues and Wikipediaing everyone who you think might have had racist connotations in their past.
So I was just going to say, we were talking earlier on, obviously race is a really important part of this, but there's a lot of other individuals have been highlighted, not just for their racist beliefs, but also for maybe LGBT beliefs or misogynistic beliefs. And it's just important to hold it that by judging it by modern standards, some of it was illegal. For myself, thinking of the Duke of Wellington before the Catholic Emancipation Act, Catholics couldn't vote or own certain areas of land in the UK. Outside of my area, homosexuality was only decriminalised relatively recently, within living memory.
So 67.
So to hold these views 200 years ago was actually in line with the law of the time. And morally, that law might have been wrong, but that's probably why they, you know, we're only going to really record people's public belief because they're speaking in letters, and we don't know what their innermost thoughts might have been.
I don't, as well, I have to say that a lot of what was levelled at us last week was that if you say that, which I agree with as it happens, but if you say that, you're saying, right, well, so we're just saying that it was okay to be a homophobe, in which case it's okay to put up statues of Hitler. Well, no, that's not what we're saying, is it?
Obviously not. No. You have to be very careful, and you have to always say to people that you do not hold these beliefs, because obviously we do not.
I suppose this is... this is it, isn't it? The problem with statues, I mean, people like, we conflate statues as history, and they are history, but they're not history of what we think they are. We often think of, when this debate goes on, we talk about, like Nelson's column, that's the history, and then they start talking about, well, as you start talking about Trafalgar, and you think, it didn't go up till the 1840s. What was it, 1843 it was complete?
Yeah.
So when we talk about context, you're absolutely right. The context of Nelson's life, really important. But also what's important is the context of why they decided to put it up.
Yeah, because now 1843 is history. The putting up of the statue is part of history now. So to just rip it down, you're deleting selectively bits of history, aren't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Of course.
Which is my huge issue.
The other side of this, of course, is... our intervention now is interrupting history as it happens. So, you know, whether or not you like these acts, these are historic acts that are going on right now. It will be remembered as a few years of protest. I mean, this isn't the first lot. I mean, what was it 2001? They boarded up Churchill before. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't new. These have always been targets, and they're targets because of their symbolism of establishment, really. You can't really get more of an establishment figure than someone like Churchill, someone like Nelson, although I personally would have said Wellington, but Nelson's so prominent in London, isn't he? Mm-hmm. So in that respect, we kind of have to be careful to so easily separate history, heritage, because ultimately a statue, no, it's not history per se, but it does hold a public memory.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, so if you go to Horse Guards Parade, there is a beautiful equestrian statue of Lord Roberts. And most people now who aren't military historians don't really know who he is or what he did. But I can stand there with the tour group and say, this is one of only three father-son pairings to win a Victoria Cross, blah, blah, blah. By the time you've told them the story, they understand why, when that statue was put there, he was held in such high regard, even though he's perhaps fallen out of it now. So they are part of our heritage, and they're a way for us to understand, like you say, not just how people thought of Nelson at the time of Trafalgar, but how Nelson was still revered in the 1840s for them to want to construct Trafalgar Square around him. And that's all become part of our history as well. So this selective deleting of bits of our history and trying to pretend, for me, pretending it didn't happen because we don't agree with everything that they said or did now is a really dangerous precedent.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily agree about it deleting history. I think our history, the way we do history over the past 150 years is created a much more complex system. You can't delete Nelson from history, even if you removed every single statue of him. You can remove him from public memory, though. Mm. And I think there is an important difference there. So, like, there's an Italian phrase, Latin phrase, a lot of people are floating about at the moment, this idea of damnatio memoriae, this idea of condemning a person's memory. It's an ancient practice. You see in ancient Egypt, probably one of the earliest, we see it with Hatshepsut, a female pharaoh who literally has her face carved on.
Sorry, I just say that I've seen that because she has one of the needles, doesn't she? And because it's so irreverent to pull one of those down, is it her stepson hated her so much that he built a freaking wall around it? There is a circular wall around it, which has now crumbled away. So you're looking at it's an obelisk put up for her, which he can't take down because the gods will hate his guts. So there's a half crumbled wall around it. And that's become history. That's brilliant, that story. I love it. I don't know why he had such a beef with his stepmom, but yeah.
No, and it's actually kind of a historical mystery. I know historians have tried to answer this question, but ultimately this is not enough data to understand it. But what's interesting is that they attempted it. The Romans, similarly, you know, they tried to eliminate emperors from the history as best they could. But, you know, some of the names they tried to get rid of are some of the most famous names you know. I mean, it's people like Nero. So removing statues, removing names from inscriptions does not equal history being lost.
But I think it's important. That's fine. I just want to give you an example, though, of how long it can take to put right. And that's Richard III. So Richard III, all of the stuff that we understood about him and trashed him with for 300-400 years came from after his last lifetime. It started like after he was gone and was made real by Shakespeare and taken down. And it's only in the last, 10 years, really, since finding him and stuff, that people have actually started to comprehend that the whole... So this is like how many generations have grown up not comprehending the proper history and the proper evidence surrounding the man because it's been clouded by a hate campaign from a later generation. And I don't want to see that happen now. I don't want to see us doing that and creating another Richard III scenario on Nelson or Wellington that's going to be taken forward. Zach, you've got your hand up.
Very polite, Zach.
I know. He's so
such a good boy.
Yeah.
I mean, did you want to come back on that first?
Oh, I was just going to jump in on that, Gareth. It's a really interesting example, Richard III. But of course, this again kind of highlights my point, which is, as you said, the history was always there.
Mm.
Even the evidence was always there. But yeah, you're right. What we're talking about there, again, is public memory, the stereotyping, the legacies, the lineage, the cultural legacy of his name and of his actions. That is what gets skewed. And yeah, I can see how you can relate that to what we're seeing now and how we're going to... I suppose it's difficult to try... I'm trying to avoid this idea. We're not rewriting history. There's this idea that history is set in stone and we're just kind of discovering it. And this is kind of a popular perception of history that I think we're taught at school, because you're taught it as facts, aren't you? And it's only when you continue reading and you realise, oh, there's actually debate. There's actually, you know, and this is ultimately what we're trying to do. So in that respect, to say we're rewriting history is kind of a misnomer, because history is just an inquiry. Of course you're rewriting it, because you're basically trying to get to a more accurate picture as best you can.
Yeah, but then equally... when people like David Baddiel come forward and say, we need to change our history. No, we don't need to actively and pointedly set out to change the narrative of history.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We don't. And again, I think this is just a bit of a disconnect with our discipline or our interest in history, because most historians, well, I think any historian would go, no, you're absolutely right, you can't go about that, but you certainly can hit it with new perspectives.
Absolutely. And if we weren't continually doing that, we wouldn't be doing our job properly.
Grammatically and physically impossible to change history unless we use a time machine, if anyone's pointed that out.
I did point out that it's gone. You can't. You can change the way you look at it, but you can't change your history.
Well, and this for me is why it's important to locate statues within the more of a discussion, not so much on history, but on public memory and memorialization and the decision for memorialization. So as Zach and, well, actually James and Marcus have all discussed, you know, these statues live in their own context, whether it's a conservation context, whether it's in the early 1800s, whether it's in the mid 1800s. They exist within these contexts, but they do also exist in our context. And I suppose this comes back to Zach's point, which is that people, we do have a right to continually have this conversation, but I suppose this comes back to everyone's point, which is the conversation. Yes. Why are you pulling it down right now? Why are you damaging these things? And again, it's a small minority. Since the Nelson thing came up, I've been looking for the petition. I can't find it. There isn't one. There is not a petition to have Nelson's column taken down. Mm. I cannot find it anywhere.
I think there was a fair amount of shit stirring going on, wasn't there?
There was a lot of stirring, and media got really in on this. Black Lives Matter movement have not asked for this. I know there's this website, Topple the Racists. It is on there. I'll give you that. It is on that website. But so are about 70 others. Some have petitions, some don't. So you've got to ask the question, going back to Zach's original point, is, you know, who's actually calling for these things? Why is this conversation happening in the way it's happening right now?
Go on, Zach.
Yeah, I mean, it taps into what you've just said there about kind of memory and how we engage with these statues and how we want to keep kind of thinking about it. Because I've been really interested to see a lot of academics that I know and really like and respect turning around and saying that, actually, you know what? Monuments as sites of education aren't particularly helpful. They don't really educate people, which has left me doing a lot of head scratching, because on a personal level, and this is based on my personal experiences as a teacher, That's not my experience. If I was to take a bunch of kids out on a tour, get them out of the classroom, take them around any site, we would stop. And tour guides, it's the same thing. It's
you would stop at these. You can achieve so much more walking around a load of London statues than you can in a classroom, can't you? Mm.
Exactly. And you stop. And what do? You discuss. You educate these people about that person and their role within society and why it is that they're memorialized. But that point about how people get that knowledge has got to be absolutely key, because if, let's go back to kids, let's say you're in a park, there's a memorial to whoever it might be. You know what kids are like. They sometimes get something in their head, they turn around, they ask their parents. Parents don't know, so they Google it, and straight away you've got the problem that we've seen at the moment, where people are embarrassing themselves. And Robert Peel's a classic example of this. But we're trying to target the statue to Prime Minister Robert Peel, who's actually the son of another guy of the same name who was anti-abolition. Robert Peel, the Prime Minister, was pro-abolition. And so what they're in effect trying to do is target the wrong guy. So I can understand why people have got an issue with Robert Peel the Elder, if you like, but they're not taking the advantage of the opportunity to properly work out who it is that they're dealing with. And for me, what it comes down to is the fact that we therefore need to find a way to make these monuments work much better to educate people. They need more information on them. And suddenly, if you can make that happen, then suddenly society starts winning, because you start to educate people properly about their history, not just this idealized kind of perception.
I mean, are we talking about a statuary advisory board where we put up new plaques on statues instead of pulling them down? I mean, like I said, we put a pin in someone like Colston that has been a contentious issue in terms of the whole of this list, we can't take them all down, and we shouldn't take everybody down, but maybe we should be looking at putting new plaques up on there, like you say, to educate people. And the ones that, like Colson, should go in a museum with those plaques. You can say, this guy was once completely revered by Bristol because he did all this, but this is where his money come from. And in the 21st century, people didn't agree with it. I just want to ask Owen, as an ancient historian, this idea that monuments don't matter as parts of history, surely that blows away a lot of your field if that's the case.
Well, that I should throw away this book I've just written.
Yeah, if that's the case. Because surely in terms of ancient history, if we start disregarding monuments and their historical importance, then I mean, surely that is so key to what you're working on in terms of war memorialization of wars and things in the ancient world. What are you going to do without that stuff?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that regard. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to be part of this conversation. I mean, anyone would be within their right to go, what the hell is an ancient historian doing in a conversation about Nelson? the reason I did it was because the importance of monuments, the importance of inscriptions, the importance of statues for my field. And it gives, because ancient historians have to deal with them in such a more direct way than perhaps other fields of history do, because quite often it's all we've got in certain areas. It just becomes much more important, which is why, you know, this conversation now, every so often I feel like I'm jumping in and being a bit of a spoil sport. We're, you know, trying to contextualize these images and these statues. And there's a reason for that, because that's what I spend most of my time having to do and doing. Mm. So the idea that statues and monuments don't teach us anything about history or don't show us anything about history is categorically false, considering everything I've already said about be careful which bit of history you think you're being told about. Where I suppose the question then comes is, from an archaeological point of view, the context of where the monument is just as important as the monument itself. So for instance, if we take Nelson's Column. We had James talk about it briefly with Trafalgar Square. The context of the column is important.
Yeah.
The physical context of the book. So I suppose a valid question, and you know, I'll throw it straight over to anyone who wants to take it, the valid question about Nelson's Column is, does it need to be in such a prominent place in London? You know, if you were going to design a monumental space in London now, would you choose Nelson to be the man who's there? Because Trafalgar Square really is just one of those iconic areas now, isn't it? And you go, is he the right man to put there now? Was he even then is a valid question, but now, is he the person you would choose to put there? I'll throw that to anyone.
Can I just quickly say, as a almost a historical fact of the time, it's not the first Nelson's Column. The first one is on the hill outside Portsmouth, which obviously has much stronger naval connections. So everything in Portsmouth seems to be named after Nelson. He was a Norfolk man. There is a first Nelson's Column. It's just not very well known. It's in the car park of what is now Fort Nelson, which is part of the Royal Armouries, Free Museum. But that was built much, much earlier to commemorate him within a naval context, within eyesight of the naval base. So I think it's before we say anything else, it's quite important to say that there was another one. And so there must have been a very important reason to say to build a second within our capital city.
Let's go to, I want to go to James on this one.
I think it, why Trafalgar Square and Nelson's column is such an interesting case study, because it interlinks with so many debates related to our statues being used politically, who was behind them in the first place, and what do they mean over time. Now, if you look at Lord Nelson's legacy, the current sort of attack on Nelson's column was believed to start in about 2005 at the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar. And sort of it's evolved into these series of let's put it this way, interpretations by some individuals, particularly at the Guardian newspaper. Of course, the Guardian newspaper has its own history with slavery itself. But what's quite interesting is the attacks on Lord Nelson go back to exactly the same year that Nelson's column was being put up in 1843, which was put up by public subscription and the Duke of Wellington. Now, there were sort of two strands behind that. One was basically saying, look, the country had been saved from invasion. This was incredibly important to Mark. And the Royal Navy at the time, the Admiralty, were very, very forceful that it had to mark all of the contribution of the Royal Navy and all the sailors ultimately in it, which is why, you know, I'd argue Nelson's column is kind of not so much about Nelson. It's about Trafalgar, it's about invasion. And if people look really closely, the plaques at the bottom actually represent most of the battles leading up to Trafalgar, and they actually represent all the ethnicities involved in the Royal Navy at the time. You know, Royal Navy was kind of ahead quite a bit of the nation on this front. So, for example, if a slave managed to escape or came aboard a British warship, they were free, and certainly at the end of service, they were free as well, which is why they're considered the same as any other sailor, paid by rate and skill, and that's why they're marked on Nelson's column as anything else. And I think, you know, Trafalgar, this is when we come back to what else does this statue actually mean, and why historians and historical methodology is important, because from this sort of accusation of Nelson being accused of being pro-slavery, sort of you start digging into this and look at, well, what's actually going on here, is then sort of start to realize that the original letter, which believed to portray Lord Nelson as being pro-slavery, actually came out the same year, or it was made public the same year that the column went up. And behind that letter was basically one of his, what would be ex-friends, I suppose you could say, who was getting very jealous of how Nelson's legacy was making him immortal, to put it in those terms. So, but as historians, we can sort of start digging into this and say, why did he say what he say? Well, at the time there'd been, that he wrote the letter, there'd been an uprising where some of his friends had been hurt. He was under huge pressure to secure the West Indies strategically. And the one that, of course, has been missed behind this fear that if Britain released those slaves, Napoleon would ultimately probably get hold of these slaves and turn them on the Royal Navy. And the big one that also the Admiralty underlined of why the Trafalgar Square, and particularly Nelson's column, was going up, was that it enabled Parliament. You can imagine Parliament's scared of invasion. You know, who wouldn't be at the time? So they were unable to be concerned about other questions in society at the time. So getting rid of invasion obviously allowed them to think a little bit about other topics, including the Anti-Slavery Act. But I think getting into then the politics behind it, you know, the question of would we choose Nelson? Well, that's when we actually get into, is Nelson's column actually about Nelson? And I think we also start reflecting on here in the 21st century, what are these actual attacks on statues about? And I could kind of say, if you don't understand Trafalgar Square, you kind of don't understand Britain because of the sea and its relationship. So it's understandable if the sea is defined Britain as a nation, how we connect through the sea, the global commons, to the rest of the world. You think about it, the sea is really central. It is our national identity. So it's kind of understandable that something like Trafalgar Square, which is so prominent, would be attacked because it's a direct attack on British culture. And we as a nation have been shaped by the sea, and it has been the global commons. So the politics behind actually having that there was as much not just saying, well, look at the Royal Navy, look at the contribution of sailors, but how does the sea and how does the Royal Navy become central to our identity? How must it be reflected in policy? And I think it's kind of if you step away from Whitehall and look at one end you've got Trafalgar Square, Nelson. Now the other end you've got Churchill, in the middle the cenotaph, and how sort of Nelson's legacy impacted Winston Churchill. You really start to get this idea of there's far more behind a statue than just glorifying an individual.
I mean, I've always taken Trafalgar Square to represent a moment in time when the Royal Navy held a much higher significance in our national identity and in our national safety and in our national progress. And I'm okay with that standing there, because that for me is a piece of living history that I can use to show people that as a historian. So in answer to your question, Owen, I have no problem with it being Nelson. I have no problem with the position it holds. I don't know if anyone disagrees, but that's what I take it at.
Certainly don't disagree. I'm thinking back to a Royal Navy recruitment campaign about 10 years ago, and they were giving out pens and t-shirts and said, "Why the Royal Navy?" And it says, "Because we're an island," underneath it. it just kind of puts into context. Yes, now we've got planes and internet age, but back then, yeah, everything did rely upon having clear channels, and if we couldn't send messages overseas on a ship, the message wouldn't go overseas. If we couldn't trade by putting it on board a ship, it wouldn't be traded. You know, you couldn't go anywhere out of United Kingdom, even to, you know, some of our colonies, and there were terrible things done, and also some positive things with fighting against Napoleon, but you couldn't do it unless you got on a ship or a boat. So we are an island, and I think that can be quite important within when we're quite looking inward to look outward, and our shores are our protection as well. Nelson's Navy and his sailors on board Victory, we know we're multi-ethnic when this comes to like a discussion about fame and representation, and they are represented on the plaques around Nelson's Column. But also, he's fighting a war against Napoleon, and I know much more about Wellington than I do know about Nelson. I'll hold my hand up and say that, but Napoleon reintroduced slavery. So if we're talking about a anti-slavery viewpoint, though they're still going to have 1800s values, Napoleon reintroduced slavery after it being abolished under the French Revolution. So to kind of quote Master and Commander here, it's the lesser of two evils, at least.
Yeah, I think in that case, are we saying that maybe it wasn't the 19th century or the 18th century Navy that was failing multi-ethnicities and honouring them, because they were honoured in 1843 when that was put up? The omission has been made in the history since, hasn't it? If people don't know when they're screaming at a pillar with Nelson on it that he did command other ethnicities, then it's not Nelson who failed, it's the generations that
failed. I see it sometimes in representation, that sometimes you do get TV dramas and they put in a diverse cast, because we are a diverse country, which is great. And I see people sometimes go, "Oh, but you wouldn't have had that person there." Well, actually, our country's been trading around the world for hundreds of years before this era. So it's not impossible that people of different ethnicities would have been there, and they would have been known. You know, we were a global power in that era.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason that Miranda Kaufman is fortunately for her, and deservedly so, they're making some form of dramatisation out of Black Tudors, because there were Black people in Tudor England, and she found them and she wrote a book about them. And so they should be, there should be a documentary, or there should be a documentary or a drama, I'm not sure what it is, with them in it. Because like you say, it's not just being woke, putting Black people in a historical drama. They were there.
Yeah, it's the same within ancient Rome dramas. If you ever have any person of colour in it, they conventionally, if they're a slave, then that's acceptable. If they're shown to be some form of citizen, we get the exact same backlash. I mean, we had one about a year or two ago, the BBC put an image of a British Roman house, basically with family, and it showed I think the male was Black, I think, and shown as a citizen. And this just annoyed many a people. But ultimately, it's the exact same. Rome was a massive empire. It was a multinational empire. It was what we would call a multiracial empire. So it's perfectly normal. It's perfectly expected to see. Which comes back to this whole thing we've been talking about, which is of education.
It is. I mean, and I think we proudly at History Hack, we've had Emma Southern talking about Syrian matriarchs, like leading Rome. We've had Black Tudors with Miranda Kaufman. And it just, it is collectively, those people were there. And if people to say they're ignorant, if people are ignorant of the fact that there were, that it's okay to have a black citizen of Rome, it's because they haven't been taught right. It's not because the BBC or whatever are trying to be woke and putting a black person in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the other thing is, I guess going back, going all the way back to the Richard III analogy, which is since the Renaissance, we've envisaged the ancient world in particular as white, not helped by the fact that people started cleaning statues.
Yes.
So, you know, for anyone who is not aware, pretty much all ancient statues around the Mediterranean were painted. You know, they're not this gleaming white marble that you see in the museums. That's not normal. If you go to the Vatican Museum in particular, you'll see a lot of them still have the paint on. But it's created this image of a white empire, and this very much influenced post-Renaissance, Enlightenment, and then, of course, the British Empire, the way the British Empire envisages itself and itself in the world. It's no secret that they modelled themselves on the Roman Empire and Greek democracy as well.
Then we need to teach people the difference between classical and neoclassical, don't we?
Spot on. Yeah, absolutely right. And this is, I suppose, where Nelson's column comes back into it, because it is a neoclassical designed monument. And there are, I mean, I know James talked about it before, he mentioned the political statements are being made. You know, yes, it is a glorious monument. Yes, it is to commemorate an invasion that was defeated, so to speak. But there is a large political statement being made with monuments like this by political elite. And that is a reality that we also have to acknowledge.
Yeah, and then that has to be part of the education process. James, finish us off.
I think the point to underline, we can see how arguments get developed because of how history is being tweaked, or how history is not being taught. There's many arguments. I mean, historians, I think, will get into about the teaching of history, when it's done, how it's done, etc. I know one in particular was when it came to this debate about Lord Nelson's column. It appeared in the Times newspaper that Lord Nelson owned slaves, and that drove his Nelson's column being put on the website to be removed. We know for absolute sure Nelson did not own any slaves. So I think it's good for historians to reflect how a public debate without historians getting involved in can really start spiraling out of control, particularly when we know we'd have to destroy evidence, which some seems inconvenient to their agendas type of thing. And that's the prime example of them claiming that Nelson owned slaves, therefore he was pro-slavery.
The fact is that we annoy people because we can never give them a straight answer. But if you want to take it and make it that black and white, literally that black and white, then you're going to end up having to dynamite Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, exactly.
So you need the nuance of historians. And unfortunately, for once, our existence is vindicated, unfortunately, for the rest of the world. And all the time we've all spent looking at dead people, actually, we do have something to bring to this discussion. And I think we are the levelers in the middle that say, you cannot. The extreme just doesn't work here.
No, and I think Nelson is the perfect example of that. Nelson's been analysed, examined, everything else since his death. And there's plenty of scholarly output on it, but it's all to do with context, isn't it? And I think that's something in the debates that we're now missing today. If somebody says, well, one letter makes him, from their interpretation, to be pro-slavery, yet 5 years beforehand he was fighting an engagement where he freed 400 slaves, which of course was against the law. Let's remember, slavery was legal. Then you start to think, well, this individual is not is simple as we're trying to make him out to be. So we always come back to why historians are important, why studying is important, and that just ruthlessly pulling down statues without understanding this really sort of diminishes our society.
I think one thing that really concerned me last week was and I don't know if it was an inability to differentiate, or whether it's just because, as it's just pointed out, the cenotaph sits in between two of the statues/monuments that were on the hit list, but the inability, it seems, of some people to differentiate between a commemoration and a memorial, and to try and set fire to flags on the memorial and to trash the cenotaph, which as a monument was unveiled in its permanent form the exact same day that we commemorated the unknown soldier, who in theory could be any colour and from anywhere in the empire. And that in turn, that cenotaph commemorates all of Britain's war dead. And in the context that it was put up in the early 20s, that means Britain and her imperial forces. That means and the Australians and the Canadians. That's Britain's whole encompassing war dead memorialized in that slab, and that people would go and trash that and not understand the difference between a statue commemorating Nelson and Trafalgar and the Navy and an individual like Winston Churchill and go and attack that. For me, that really tipped me over the edge. I don't know about you guys.
Go on, Zach.
This is what really started to shake me in terms of how much people are kind of escalating it, because you've talked about the cenotaph, and I'm with you all the way on what you've said there, Alex. I was having conversations with friends of mine, historians, people who I know are properly decent at what they do, and saying, well, look, so where do we take this? Do we take a wrecking ball to Nelson's column? Do we even go so far as advising the French to bulldoze Napoleon's tomb? And people coming around, turning around and saying, yes, absolutely. It's a sign of white supremacy. Tear it all down. And I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. We're talking here about desecrating people's graves. Have some bloody respect for the dead. Do you know what I mean? I mean, if that's where people want to go with this, then good luck with where it's going to end. Because this is the sort of thing that we did with Cromwell back in 1660 after the restoration of Charles II.
The way he was repeatedly dug up.
Exactly. Mm. And I'd like to think as a society, we've kind of moved on a little bit and become fractionally more civilized than we were back then.
And I would like to think that we understood the difference between white supremacy and a monument that merely and wholly is there to commemorate all those who did or did not agree with the reasons for going to war, but who laid down their lives or their lives were taken from them unwillingly during it. I'd like to think that we progressed to a place where we could understand the nuance in that.
Well, and also with the cenotaph in particular, that is still a sacred space of mourning.
Hmm.
You know, people may get cynical and talk about the politicization every Remembrance Day, where we see prime ministers not turn up properly dressed to address it. But that's not the point. Veterans, thousands of veterans go to this monument every year. You know, families will still find solace in this cenotaph. And of course, it's not the only cenotaph. There's one in Manchester as well. You know, these are not dead monuments.
No, they're not. And even though the way people regard them when they go has evolved over the last 100 years, I mean, in the immediate aftermath of World War One, Remembrance Day was a massive piss up. London was absolutely heaving with soldiers coming out to party and celebrate their lost friends. And because we didn't experience, and the more those wars go out of living memory, the more reverent we become and the more solemn we become about the commemoration, because we haven't earned the right to regard it in that way, I think is the collective response to it. But still, you're right, it is a living, breathing monument and solace to people who have lost someone in war.
Yeah, well, I would, you know, to take it to its extreme, I'd rather you took all the statues down than you did anything to that cenotaph, if given the choice. That cenotaph is exactly as you said; it's a symbolic burial for all servicemen and women from past and to present. It is still used for this kind of this symbolic burial for those who, in particular, cannot come home.
Yes.
You know, absolutely. Think of the families who never get to touch or bury the bodies of their loved ones.
And I mean, it is intrinsically linked with the unknown soldier as well. They were both, he was buried on the day that was properly unveiled. George V oversaw both. And for me, they are one and the same. One stands out on the road and one stands in the Abbey. What they are there for people to use as a comfort and a solace.
But initially it was temporary, wasn't it?
It was made out of wood and plaster. It looked exactly the same, The king, I think, had been there when they... And this is the one example I found of George V misjudging public opinion, because he was asked if he wanted to unveil the permanent one, and because it had already stood there in plasterboard for 2 years or whatever. And he said, no, you're all right, thanks. I don't think it's necessary, is it? And the stink it kicked up. And it's the one example I can find of him misjudging public opinion. Usually he inherited that from his grandmother. He was very good at gauging what things meant to people and why, and that's the one he missed. And he did go and he did it, and he didn't complain about it. And when people started to get het up, he was like, oh right, I just didn't realize that was going to be the collective response and that it meant that much. And the unknown soldier, the cortege paused at the cenotaph. So for me, they are completely intertwined. And if you disrespect one, you're disrespecting the other.
And so just quickly, there are different legal protections over war memorials. I have had to, unfortunately, remind people of this in my line of work. But war memorials, just by, because they often belong to anyone, they often belong to the nation. And they are protected, rightly so, I believe. And so by damaging them in any way, shape or form, physically damaging them, it is a crime. The other one, going back to it, is putting on a completely different hat, which I know Zach knows about, but I'm lucky enough, and it's a big part of my life, that I'm a army reservist. And about 3 years ago, 2017, I think, I was very lucky that I was in one of the guards on the cenotaph, and it was the last time Her Majesty walked into and laid a wreath herself. And I have to say, my 11-year part-time career, it stands out as being equally one of the highlights, and it's going to stay with me, I know, to my last dying memories. It's such a poignant thing. I mean, you stand there in one of the guards, I think it's about 4.5 hours, because you stand there for the march past afterwards, but it is the cenotaph. And though I've been to over 11 Remembrance Sunday services, there's nothing quite like A, having your sovereign there, but B, actually that kind of goes out the window when you see all the veterans and all the widows and all the orphans and all the disabled veterans as well, including Chelsea pensioners and PC winners. It has such poignancy of all backgrounds and ethnicities.
I pity the people that can't divorce in their minds the concept of white supremacy and the concept of that. What you're talking about, and which obviously gives you so much pride.
You almost need like a badge saying not all soldiers are white.
Yes, exactly. And in actual fact, if you look up at the makeup of the British Army now, they're most certainly not all white.
They don't need to be.
No, exactly.
Exactly. We're just soldiers.
James, you've got your hand raised.
I was just sort of thinking, when if you were to draw a line from Trafalgar Square to the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior, the one for sort of the Navy and sailors is very important, with Nelson being so central to Royal Navy identity, is the amount of sailors who have no graves. Although the cenotaph is a place for the Navy and the Maritime as much as anybody else, Nelson being so central sort of underlines how Trafalgar Square is seen also, or was designed to be, a place of remembrance. In fact, the plans for it was to have, you could almost walk through not just the history of this nation, but it was a place of remembrance under the sort of eyes of Lord Nelson, per se, because it was so central. And I think it's one with a real question comes down to is, what are these statues best remembered for? What is the cenotaph mainly remembered for? Nelson inspired the entire Navy. Now, if you start thinking how long from 1805 it is to 2020, he inspired a Navy to be what is still the most successful fighting force in the world. It's respected for its, I think, humility and humanity in war. But a more serious side of this is trying to escape and understand empire and imperialism. And I think this is a big problem for historians. And I would say, part of my research at King's, which is also a maritime strategy, there's been an almighty headache for navies post-1945 to kind of get away from this argument that the Navy is just for imperialism and is just for empire. So it's kind of exposing...
it's just a basic nuance, isn't it? You can't attack the entire establishment in history for slavery when you don't personally understand what part the Royal Navy played as part of the establishment in eradicating slavery worldwide.
Yeah, and I mean, the Royal Navy, I mean, defeat of Napoleon enabled the Royal Navy to have resources to go and fight slavery, and that was something that Britain invested a considerable amount of resources in. It wasn't an easy, you know, it wasn't one day this was banned, the next day it was over by any terms. But that was a long campaign for the Navy to do, and ultimately pitted us against other nations at times, particularly the United States, which I think is quite topical. So when we start trying to understand, well, what are some of these statues and Trafalgar Square is about, it's actually a lot more about the story of the Royal Navy, and that is just that is not just Lord Nelson, that is not just Trafalgar. What is it saying? And I think this kind of links in Winston Churchill as well. Do we sort of look at that statue and say, that is Winston Churchill the man, or is that Britain's fight against fascism? And that's what I know I certainly took away when they were writing, you know, racists on it. I felt that was more of an attack on Britain's legacy of fighting, you know, standing alone and then fighting against fascism in World War II than anything.
Well, you only have to look at what is that representation of Winston Churchill. That man was in public service for decades. But what is the image of him standing on that plinth? It's the 1940s. It's an image of that man in 1940, as I picture him when he was talking about the few, when he was epitomising Britain not surrendering and not giving in to fascism. It's not a statue of him as an old man, is it? It's not a statue of him as a young imperialist journalist/soldier. It's the statue of him in World War II.
And I think it's a very... the way in which it's done, I think it's fair to say, is a very hostile attack on our past and sort of interrogation of our past. And they're kind of doing it in countries which are the most free and the most tolerant, which in the case of, you know, Winston Churchill, and like we just said, it represents that fight. How do we think we became to a nation that was such so free and so tolerant? You could pretty much be sure what Adolf Hitler would have thought about, the treatment.
Well, had he won the war,
what he would have thought about
like that, you'd be gunned down, wouldn't you?
Yeah, the black community, the gay community, whatever it might be. We certainly, I think, can say how we would have treated those communities. So,
yeah.
It is very hostile, I think, to these attacks on sort of our countries when you think that we are the most free and tolerant, but also being free and tolerant enables us to have these conversations. But I do think we have a major problem with empire and imperialism, and that's historians have got, I think, much to blame for that, maybe as anything else.
Zach?
Personally, I agree. I mean, guys, do you want me to shut up? Because I've spoken a lot here.
Fine with you talking.
Sure.
Yeah, we're utilising the little... When I say people have got their hands raised, I don't want listeners to think that they're literally sitting there with their hand up. Like,
yeah.
It's the little button on Zoom. It just means that they've hit the little blue hand button, so I know they want to talk. Please don't get this little
classroom. Does this not mean we get biscuits and glasses of squash afterwards, I promise?
Oh, my days.
Only if it's not the orange and pineapple squash, because the pineapple bit used to make me gag, and they used to give us that all the time after netball. No, people aren't actually raising their hands. But no, I think you are the only one with your hand raised right now, Zach. But
I just
want to finish your thought.
Oh, I just wanted to jump in just before Zach does jump in, because I just wanted to point out, going back to Zach's point a minute ago about the wider discussion that's supposed to be going on and how we're very much obsessing over statues. It says a lot when the Prime Minister decides to talk about this publicly when he's not talking about so much else publicly. It's also worth noting that a lot of the discussion in groups like the Black Lives Matter forums and things, and groups like Toppling the Racists, they're not talking about burying this.
Yeah.
Actually, the message is basically white people of Britain need to own up to this and understand it better. And I think that's a message a lot of us can agree with.
Definitely. But I don't think that that's achieved by ripping statues down, which I think is actually what we're all saying. And I think what this conversation has been really good for is that if anyone out there, so the Black Lives Matter people that just came at us, and I mean, as an ethnic minority, I was surprised at the amount of abuse I've got, which in some instances was just based on my name, which is Churchill, obviously, and in other instances just boiled down to them pretending I wasn't an ethnic minority and screaming white supremacy in my face. But actually, for Zach to stand up and say some of this, as he did on Twitter, really put his head above the parapet. And I think the people on the people making these lists and the people out there that are advocating ripping this down and a violent appraisal of our history need to understand that the people opposing them aren't just the loony right-wing fringes that showed their face doing their Hitler salutes yesterday in London. There are educated people like us that oppose the approach they're taking, and that they need to understand that they can't just scream white supremacist to every single one of them.
But I think that's an important point. And also what you were saying about, it's not, I mean, some of you may disagree, but for me, it's not necessarily the removal of some of these statues. We talked about Causton as a classic example. Mm. That's not the problem. But the it's the approach, I think, is a really, yeah, that's the nail on the head there.
Yeah, I mean, if an advisory board exists, then it's an educated approach and it's a discussion, and it's not just people going out with spray paint and screaming in other people's faces with their views, is it? But Zach, go on. And then I know Marcus wants to come in.
Yeah, there are a few things. So sorry, Marcus, this might sort of take a little bit longer than perhaps you'd like.
Stop apologising. We brought you here to talk about this stuff. And we've brought people in that aren't afraid to talk about this stuff. And I just have to say that all four of the people in this chat with me, and I may be brown, but these guys are white, and they've been brave enough to come forward and say their piece. And I actually really respect you all for doing this. So don't for one moment, Zach, think that you don't deserve the forum to then say your piece.
Funnily enough, when we were talking about this beforehand, having had the blowback on Twitter, I kind of figured that my career was over anyway as an academic. So,
but this is, it shouldn't be. And that's what makes me angry. That's what I'm saying when I say that they cannot, the people that made those lists can't just scream white supremacism in the face of every white man that opposes ripping down all of these statues. Because in this virtual chat with me are four white men who are educated and just have a nuanced perspective on it, and an educator, and they don't necessarily agree with you about ripping all these statues down, but that doesn't mean that they're right-wing nutjobs. So yeah, go ahead and make your point, Zach.
In terms of this whole white supremacy argument, I'll be honest, I'm not, and I'm sure many people aren't surprised that this whole kind of tear it down line of reasoning has played into the hands of the far right. And I'm not saying for one second that we don't need to confront this. As you've heard, I'm absolutely saying, actually, I would much rather that we felt uncomfortable and dealt with that fact. Mm-hmm. But nobody can have been amazed at the fact that the far right used this as an excuse to come out over
to politicize it, and come out and be arseholes, which frankly, every one of you standing there doing a Nazi salute and beating up policemen who, forgive me, are not the ones trying to take the statues down, you are arseholes.
I think it's so important to emphasize that not all monument defenders are fascists. But there's a deeper thing here about, I kind of feel we should be a little bit more clever than the far right on this, because this kind of gives them a bit of ammunition. Because if you stop pulling down these statues and burning them without having a discussion first, they can use it in their kind of screwed up way to claim that, oh, our national heritage is under threat, and it's a conspiracy from the far left to try and make Britain less British, whatever the hell that's meant to mean. And we can be cleverer than that. Because if you don't like a statue, first of all, research it so you know why it's there in the first place, so you don't end up with these embarrassing situations that we've talked about already.
Well, like, that woman turning up yesterday online that's been pilloried because she actually said she couldn't say whether Churchill was a racist or not because she hadn't met him.
Which was really unfortunate, wasn't it?
It was, but you're right. You have to educate yourself before. You have to be smarter than just kicking people who come near the statue, don't you?
Mm, completely. Yeah, I'd like to see the government actually do something constructive about this rather than say, oh no, national monuments are off the list. I think there still needs to be a conversation. And one final thing, and then I'm going to wind my neck in, finally. I just want to talk a little bit. I want to use a quote from Barack Obama on call-out culture, because I think it's relevant to this whole kind of Twitter viper's nest thing that we've been talking about. It comes from, if you want to look this up, he said it in October 2019, and it was cited in a New York Times article. I'm quoting him directly here. He says, "This idea of purity, and you're never compromised, and you're always politically woke," his words, not mine, "and all that stuff. You should get over that quickly. The world is messy. There are ambiguities. People who do really good stuff have flaws." And he continues, "I do get a sense sometimes how among certain young people," and this is accelerated by social media, "there is this sense sometimes of the way of me making change is to be as judgmental as possible about other people, and that's enough. Like if I tweet or hashtag about how you didn't do something right, or use the wrong verb, then I can sit back and feel good about myself because, man, you see how woke I was? I called you out. That's not activism. That's not bringing about change. If all you're doing is casting stones, you're probably not going to get far. That's easy to do. And if all we're going to do is pull down statues and scream at people, then seriously, what's the point? You know, history teachers love to say that we learn from the past to stop it happening again, and I'm not sure we actually do.
We need to put where our mouth is and show that then, don't we? Like we're saying, if you have to assess and have a conversation and have an advisory board, I think there are 5 people sitting in this Zoom chat that were saying we would donate some of our time to being on that advisory board and talking to people and actually properly assessing the value of individual monuments. Zach, thank you for that. I think that, like you say, that quote is perfect. And I think it's important for everyone to say that Zach was quoting Obama there, so don't come at him with the whole idea of having a go at wokes, because he was making a point based on a very intelligent man's summary of the situation. James?
I was sort of thinking the one we have to point out, I think, as historians, that there's very little difference between the far left and the far right. We've seen cultural Marxism come out this week, and as expected, I think a lot of people put on Twitter was that, you know, that the far left comes out and then the far right appears, and it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy that somebody will say something will happen and something else will happen. I think always though the simple way, and I sometimes feel that maybe academics go, you know, scream at this, is if you kind of bury the past or you remove these statues, that future generations have nothing to learn from. And that kind of is a bit of an open-ended argument. You'd say, well, we've got history books, we've got history qualifications and everything else. But we all know that public policy is not driven by historians. And actually there's very few people nowadays probably with a history qualification involved in public policy. Mm. So I do think there's always a question to do with if we bury or destroy, or however you want to put it, does that question which some ask, can we repeat history? Is it going to happen again if we get rid of it? And there's pros and cons against that argument. But I think statues also expose maybe kind of like mobilities in our society to learn from. But for too long, there's been kind of an unfair balance holding the past to ransom. Particularly Britain, and I think there's Britain and Europe and the rest of the world we've got to be careful of, but usually Britain's past compared to other nations by modern standards, when the past is a product of their times, it must be considered so. But for too long, people have got away with lying about the past is equally as about lying for the present. And if you look at this whole movement recently about statues, some of these lies are succeeding because people aren't desiring better. And I think this from an earlier comment, they're not arguing about building a better tomorrow. We're kind of arguing about stuff in the past and diverting resources to it instead of maybe, I don't know, focusing on COVID-19 instead. But behind them, you start digging into this, is an attack on capitalism. I noticed the website that has about pulling these statues down, it says about removing President Trump from office. One could say, well, what have our statues to do with President Trump? So people are kind of being played by these some of these agendas behind it, and that's not really fair, I think, on having a discussion in our country. It's also worth underlining that the fact we live in such a free country is that we can have discussions about these statues.
Yep, absolutely.
I've also, something else I picked up on is something which might be slightly theoretical, but it's this post-colonial guilt Europe and Britain, and we're summing up ourselves by collectively our worst moments, and on the flip side, other countries by their best. And I think this is really demoralizing, not only to the debate, but also our identity as well, because I think anybody would understand that human nature, I think it was quoted earlier, Barack Obama's statement, is messy. And it's kind of saying, well, all our nations are terrible and we've never done anything good. There's no way of putting it, but that's a lie.
Yeah. And humanity will always remain messy. I think the fact that these people seem to think that we're striving for a place where we can say we are squeaky clean now because we ripped all these statues down and we pilloried ourselves and flagellated ourselves for all the wrongs we ever did. And now we're perfect. That's never going to happen. You're on a hiding to nothing.
No, and I think also the past, something that's changed, and I know this is something we've been discussing quite a bit in the Department of War Studies, is this kind of society's concern about engaging in ideas because of what in the past ideas led to. You think of the 20th century, it led to the two worst pillars there is. There's communism and fascism. So now there's almost this kind of guilt of and this fear in society of engaging ideas. So what do statues represent? Well, for many people, those statues represent a past where political ideas were being thrown around that led to, you know, things like the terrors of the 20th century, that of course people don't really feel comfortable discussing anymore. The flip side of that is, because we're not talking about it, then we end up with a scenario where things are made very black and white and we start tearing down statues where really we don't understand them in the slightest.
Guys, I think we have 100%, I know we're biased, but vindicated our opinion that history does matter.
Yeah, completely. I mean, the bottom line is this, isn't it? That history is the study of human beings. Human beings are deeply flawed. We have to accept that, we have to confront that, and we have to find a way to reconcile that within the national narrative and do something positive off the back of having that conversation. And just tearing them down and hiding them from view, in my opinion, and I've probably said far too much on this, is that we're not doing that if we just take them down. We need to confront it.
No, I think you've made a really valuable contribution, Zach, and I think that is a great place to end. Guys, thank you so much for having, well, the guts, basically, because like I said, you are all young white men. Therefore, you're about the only group that it is okay to completely flagellate and scream at without any comeback. And you've all come on and honestly given your opinion as to why the way that some people wanted to approach this is not right and why history does matter and why it has to be taken into consideration. So thanks a lot for coming on, because I think it was a really engaging conversation, not really a debate because we're mostly on the same page, but in the same way we don't agree on all of it 100%, and we've just been grown-ups about it, and I think what we're saying is that everyone else needs to follow that lead.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Join us a bit later on when we will be talking to Peter Caddick-Adams and Roger Morehouse about Churchill. We've tagged this as an idiot's guide to Churchill, but essentially what we're doing is you can't cover the man in one podcast. So we have taken all of the accusations levelled at him last week in that total shitstorm online, and we've addressed them one by one. So we'll be talking about genocide, we'll be talking about the famine in Bengal, we'll be talking about whether he was a white supremacist or not, and bringing some context and some nuance that is not possible to do on Twitter when people are just shrieking at each other. We'll be bringing that to a conversation where you can sit and, if you were of a mind to, educate yourself on Churchill and understand what was being said and events that were referenced in context with history like a grown-up. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower, and I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders. Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.